Like many people, she had closed her mind to any ideas which differed from her preconceived notions. While arranging my lecture for the UFO group of Sydney, I learned the group did not want to sponsor me as an organization. Still, they wished me to lecture for them. A foreigner in Australia must have a work permit. Lecturing is considered work, whether the lecturer is paid or not. This permit had not been issued, and since the group seemed reluctant to assist me in securing a permit, I became apprehensive. I was not sure that the government would allow me to lecture in Sydney. During the pre-lecture press conferences and radio TV appearances, I could not mention the lecture because the situation was so uncertain. The time for the lecture was drawing near, tickets had been sold and many persons who wanted to attend could not be accommodated. The committee in charge of the lecture arrangements continued to insist that a work permit was not necessary. At this point I grew wary, sensing that their actions might be part of a plan to stop the lecture too by getting me into difficulty with the government. I refused to lecture without the permit. The whole situation seemed to be a plot, and later evidence confirmed my beliefs. A committee member finally secured the work permit, and the group sponsored my lecture in Sydney. The lecture was very well received, and when it was over I was asked if I had a permit from the censor's office to show the film. This came as a surprise, because previous arrangements with the immigration department had supposedly taken care of the matter. I replied that a permit had not been issued and stated that the film would not be shown again until official permission had been received in writing. The incident served to alert me that new efforts would be made to stop the lectures, or at least to prevent me from showing the film. We finally went to the censor's office, set up a projector and showed the film. The officials seemed amazed at the films, and after the showing, a permit was issued. Now the trouble was ended, at least from that quarter. Once these problems had been solved and were out of the way, I found the people of Sydney to be very courteous and receptive. On March 4, I flew to Perth. There I met Bob Morrow, who writes for the Southwestern Times, a large newspaper. Morrow was an interesting person and wrote many fine articles on space. I truly enjoyed my talks with him concerning the space people and their visits. My host in Perth, leader of the local Flying Saucer Club, was a kind and hospitable person. In Adelaide, after my second successful lecture in that city, a group of us were standing outside the hall waiting for transportation. One of the ladies sighted several spaceships. Some of the ladies in the group observed the craft in detail before the ships passed out of sight. A priest approached the group and asked me to lecture at the local orphanage. After the lecture, a lovely luncheon was served by the sisters. All the children, priests, and sisters were very kind and seemed intensely interested in the space program. As I was getting ready to leave for Melbourne, I was asked why the spaceships did not land in Australia. I replied that they might after I had gone. A landing did occur, much to their surprise. This landing took place before I left Adelaide, but was not publicized until I arrived in Melbourne. Imagine my surprise when I read in the Sunday Mail of March 28, the following article: "We saw a spaceship, eerie object puzzles town," by staff reporter John Pinkney. Did a spaceship from an alien planet land this month in South Australia? Eerie happenings in the township of Pernon, 91 miles northeast of Adelaide, are prompting residents to ask this question seriously. In recent weeks, weird, multicolored objects have streaked across Pernon's skies, frightening the townsfolk. Two local men swear that on March 13, they saw a huge dome-shaped craft take off from a field. The men are Mr. Percy Briggs, Pernon landing carrier, and Mr. Carl Towill, postmaster at Claypans. Mr. Towill said, "The thing was bigger than an airliner. Mr. Briggs and I are convinced that it was intelligently controlled." The two men said they saw an enormous dome-shaped craft glowing in the dark, and as they walked towards the mysterious object it rose silently into the air, hovered, then shot away at immense speed. During my stay in Melbourne I enjoyed a warm welcome from the local UFO study group. I remained in their city from March 16 to 30. The press in both Adelaide and Melbourne was very cooperative. In Melbourne a photo was taken of me on top of a large building overlooking the city. A strong wind was blowing, and I have several times heard comments laughingly made that the picture made it look as though I was about to take off. This photo and a number of my spacecraft pictures were combined with a lengthy feature article in today's Herald Nice Reel of March 19. The following Sunday night I appeared on Meet the Press program of Australia. The results of this appearance were most favourable. After the appearance I interrupted my visit in Melbourne to fly to Hobart, Tasmania for a private lecture. Returning to Melbourne, I once again resumed my tour, going by plane to Brisbane where my stay proved to be more of a holiday than work. The good people of that city took care of my every need, and left me plenty of time for rest and relaxation. As an introduction to one of my lectures in Brisbane, the students of a public school put on a show. The boys were made up with green grease paint, and were dressed as green men from Mars. They wore little caps with antennae attached and presented a short drama. Then they encircled me and sang their version of a Martian song and chant. There was no rowdyism, nor were destructive tactics used. The Brisbane students were open-minded and eager to learn. The public listened attentively to the lecture. Here, as elsewhere, hundreds were turned away and could not gain admission. I will always remember the fine cooperation of the press, the public, and the research group in Brisbane. While there, I had an opportunity to see the Russian motion picture, Blazing a Trail to the Stars. Several scenes in the film were nearly identical with things I had seen inside the huge spaceships. Some of these were things I had never mentioned to the public. Perhaps a Russian has been inside the spacecraft also? If the Russians continued to produce films as factual and interesting as that one, the American producers, with fantastic stories about monsters from space, will be left far behind. In Europe I learned that American space films are considered gruesome. Most people overseas prefer the European films. They desire more factual presentations, and fewer of the horrors from space. Before leaving Brisbane I decided to take a brief tour through the Lone Pine Koala Sanctuary. This particular sanctuary was started in 1927 by Mr. Cam Reed and was the first privately owned and operated sanctuary in Australia. The koala is a primitive type of animal. It carries its young similar to a kangaroo and subsists on leaves from the eucalyptus tree. It needs no water throughout its entire lifetime. The Lone Pine Sanctuary had 100 or more koalas who were tame and in perfect health, all having been bred at the sanctuary. A small zoo nearby housed other animals including the emu, kangaroo, wallaby, wallaroo, dingo, opossum and the python snake. I found that the kangaroo is hunted and eaten in Australia, just as we do deer here in the United States. It is the main food from the Australian Aborigine. When I left the sanctuary I travelled 15 miles down the Brisbane River by motor launch. It provided a very scenic and enjoyable river cruise all the way. After my Australian lectures were completed, I flew to Darwin on the northern tip of Australia, to board the plane for London. The farewell party and the goodbyes at the Brisbane airport will always be remembered. I was sorry that I could not continue an enjoyable stay with my newfound friends. 3. Darwin to England. My plane left Darwin on the evening of April 16, 1959. Ahead of me was a flight of about 11,000 miles. Our first refueling stop was at Singapore. Here it was very hot and humid. When I went into the airport lounge I found a telegram waiting for me, a request from the BBC in London, England, to appear on their program Panorama the following Monday. I accepted by wire, boarded the plane, and again was on my way. Our next stop was Bangkok, capital of Thailand. Here three buses met our plane. The passengers were directed aboard the buses, and all were taken through the outskirts of the city to a club where we were served food and drinks. We dined on a terrace which gave an excellent view of this scenic city. It was very colorful, as in the States, people were coming and going all the time. I was interested in the natives and wondered what their reaction would be to the subject of space travel. Finally I found one who could speak English and engaged him in conversation. He gave me a new perspective on the matter. There are records in some Far Eastern nations containing a great deal of information regarding earlier visits from the space people. These historical accounts tell of the ancient times when spacemen frequently visited Earth. The man to whom I was talking said the people are not holy enough for spacecraft information. Only a few here and there could be given the information, and they guarded it carefully until they felt the people could benefit from knowledge. That will probably not be for some time, I commented. That depends upon the individual, he replied. Some are awakening now, but the majority of the people are asleep. And so it is. While it is not a question of how holy a person is, it is a question of how much understanding and knowledge the individual has gained. Some people are capable of opening their minds enough so that they can extend their thoughts and interests into space and wonder about our neighbors on other planets and their way of living. Others, those with closed minds, find themselves unable to think about anything beyond the confines of their own limited personal lives. Our next stop was Calcutta, seventh largest city in the world, and the greatest center of industry in India. We landed at Dumdum Airport, where I was greeted by Dr. S. K. Matra of Banaras Hindu University and a group of his friends and associates. Pictures were taken as I walked down the steps from the plane, and as I reached the ground a wreath of flowers was placed around my neck. A large number of natives standing outside the fence cheered and waved salutations as Dr. Matra and his friends greeted me. I felt their heartwarming sincerity and appreciation of the message which I had been entrusted to give to the people of the world. Dr. Matra was dressed in a white linen cap, long white jacket and white trousers. His companions were all dressed in white also, but he alone wore the long white jacket. These garments were in contrast to the modernized industrial background of Calcutta. I had corresponded with the good doctor for a number of years and knew that he and his friends wished to be brought up to date on the space people and their visits. I knew that Hindu history is filled with accounts of vehicles from space appearing on Earth, and of their occupants alerting Earthmen to the changes taking place on their planet. Dr. Matra had many questions to ask regarding present-day conditions and the latest information from the brothers. Prior to my arrival, arrangements had been made through the university to permit me to visit with these friends, apart from the other tourists, so that we would not be interrupted. I was glad to answer many of their questions with information given by my friends from other planets. During our visit, I was asked to lecture to the students of the university, but, unfortunately, there was insufficient time, as my plane was due to leave. I felt badly about this and hope that someday I will be permitted to return and address the student body. In India alone, through the efforts of Dr. Matra and his friends, the significance of changing times has been recognized and an annual celebration has been observed on November 20, in commemoration of my first meeting with a spaceman in 1952. In some publications of India, leading educators and men of science have contributed articles that substantiated earlier knowledge gained from Hindu history. They pleaded for greater friendship between Earth and our interplanetary visitors and a greater understanding among men of Earth. I was sorry to leave these true friends, but too often one must depart from the pleasant and continue along the highway of life. Our next stop was Karachi, bustling seaport capital of Pakistan, once known as Kalaki, the land of sand dunes. One of the Karachi airport officials, asking that his name be withheld, told me his people knew a great deal about space people and said that the population of his native territory had been aided in various ways by them. Someday, through the efforts of our neighbors from other planets, he said, India and Pakistan will become as brothers in one big family. On one or two occasions in the past 12 years, some government officials and religious leaders have dined with the visitors, he added. I acted surprised. What did they look like? You could be one, for they look no different from Earthmen, he replied. Were you ever among the privileged ones? I asked. No, he said. I received my information from a high government official who was present at the time. He indicated that more than one government of the world had had similar experiences. If these men would come out with what they know, it would probably help this troubled world immensely, I remarked. He replied that perhaps it would not help, and commented, you see, in these days men are fighting over opinions, not truth, for they no longer know what the truth is. Our conversation lasted for several minutes, during which he expressed the belief that some men will sacrifice family or whatever else is involved for self-gain. Self-opinionated men, heads of the masses, are willing to sacrifice those they represent in order to prove their opinions and keep their positions. The world at present is being fed indigestible food by politicians and religious leaders, and is being made sick. That is why the men who know the truth cannot or will not speak. Any truth spoken now would be discredited by those two forces. The public has been schooled to accept official opinions as facts. I was interested in hearing this analysis of world conditions expressed by an official in the airport of a Far Eastern nation. It was in total agreement with what I had learned in my travels, as well as with what I had been told by the brothers. Much as I would have liked to have continued my visit with this interesting person, plane time had arrived and I had to go aboard and continue on once again. When we left Darwin, we had been told that no photographs could be taken while we were in flight. This was disappointing, for, as we flew over Egypt, I missed a chance for some beautiful shots of the pyramids. I also saw the reasons for the restrictions, for there were many military planes on the ground and ready for action. These were plainly visible as we flew over Cairo. After a brief stop in Cairo, we went on to Athens. I had to forego the pleasure of seeing the Parthenon, the Temple of Nike, the Acropolis and other famed sites, due to lack of time. We stopped briefly in Rome, then proceeded on to England. I arrived in London on April 18, 1959. The flight into London was very beautiful. Desmond Leslie and Mr. John M. Lade met me at the airport and took me to the Hyde Park Hotel, where reservations had been made before my arrival. I had dinner with Desmond Leslie, then appeared on the BBC program In Town Tonight. The next day was Sunday, so I spent it with Desmond Leslie and his family, who showed me the sights around London. Monday I was scheduled to appear on the BBC television program Panorama. According to reports I had received, this program is one of their best TV shows, with an estimated viewing audience of 9 million. My appearance was to be in the form of a debate with Patrick Moore, well-known British astronomer. We arrived at the studio early and were having lunch when Mr. Moore came in. I was introduced to him and we chatted a moment before the program director called him to the opposite side of the room. It appeared that the director was coaching him in regards to how the program should be handled. I was unconcerned, for as I shook his hand I had realized that man to man we were friends, but he had a job to do and as a recognized authority of astronomy he would have to oppose me and try to prove me false. He had a daily program on the BBC network and at least a portion of his income depended on that program. As the show started, he tried to disqualify my knowledge of astronomy, but his attempts were unsuccessful. The program was entirely too short, and, unfortunately, public opinion went against him. Even the most hardened critic stated in the next day's press that I had won the debate by sheer dignity. Public reaction was very great and Moore was given 2 months' leave of absence from the show. I regretted this turn of events for him. At the same time, I realized that if it had not been for the assistance from my space friends Moore could have massacred me before the public. It took more than terrestrial knowledge to see through the methods which were used in his attempt to discredit me. If I had not been advised by the space people during my trip, I would have easily succumbed. As a man and a scientist, I have the utmost respect for Patrick Moore. After the show was over we went to my hotel. Desmond Leslie and several other people accompanied us. There we had an interesting pro and con discussion about the program. It seemed to me that Moore was satisfied with the results of the debate. As I think it over now, he may have wanted it to turn out that way, for he had been one of the British astronomers, along with Dr. H. Percy Wilkins, who had confirmed the existence of Dimecrisium Bridge on the Moon. He must have known for certain that someone had been using the Moon as a base of operations, and the only logical ones were people from other planets. A public lecture had been scheduled for Tuesday, April 21, at Tunbridge Wells. When we arrived by car, I was cordially received by Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding. I asked if the lecture and film permits had been obtained and was told that an official had said they would not be necessary. Lord Dowding assured me this was correct, but I knew better. Upon my arrival in the country, my passport had been stamped tourist. That meant I was not to work in England, paid or not. This presented a big problem, for I refused to work without the written permit. All tickets had been sold, and Lord Dowding was very perturbed. He called Biss's attorney, who told him it was quite all right to proceed with the lecture. Another friend talked with the attorney and was told the same. Then I was asked to speak with the attorney. When he said everything was in order, I asked him if he would put that in writing. When he said, "No, it is not necessary," I stood my ground. By this time, they all thought I was pretty stubborn and didn't know the law. I was sorry to put them to so much bother, but I did not dare give the opposition a legal loophole by which they might stop my lectures or confiscate my film. The people in England were sincere, but were not aware of what was involved. They had not been alerted to the powerful influence of the Silence Group, and to the lengths to which this group had gone to keep the truth from the public. It was finally decided that Lord Dowding would preside and I would act as guest speaker to answer people's questions. This would be satisfactory, since it was handled as a club meeting and no permit was necessary. I was seated on the platform with Lord Dowding. He explained to the audience that, due to certain circumstances, the lecture as scheduled would not be given, but that I would answer questions pertaining to my experiences. He also announced that if any wished their money refunded, it would be done. No one asked for a refund. Lord Dowding asked the first question and the meeting lasted 2 hours. When we returned to London, a written permit was obtained from the Ministry of Labour and National Service. This permit was good for the whole of the British Isles. My next lecture was scheduled for April 23rd at Weston-super-Mare. Desmond Leslie drove me to the railroad station and helped me get settled in my compartment. When we entered the compartment reserved for me, we were surprised to find another passenger seated there. The train was ready to move, so Desmond didn't have a chance to inform him of his mistake. Desmond and I shook hands and said goodbye just as the train started to move. After a short interval, the man in my compartment started a conversation. To my amazement, he was a spaceman working as a scientist on projects for the British government. He, and countless others like him, are working in various scientific projects for every government in the world. In this way, the space people can help us reach out into space, with our own science and our own ships, bringing us nearer to the understanding that abundant intelligent life exists throughout the cosmos. This is the only way the people of Earth can be awakened from their state of lethargy and apathy, into the realization that a far greater destiny than they ever imagined awaits them. Weston-super-Mare was a very pretty coastal town, situated where Bristol Channel and the River Severn blend. The hall chosen for the lecture was filled to capacity with people from all over the western coastal area. A great deal of interest was displayed toward the lecture and the films, and many intelligent questions were asked. During my stay in Bournemouth, friends arranged a meeting for me with Leonard G. Cramp, author of Space, Gravity and the Flying Saucer 6. Cramp, a member of the Interplanetary Society of England and an expert engineer, proved the authenticity of my still photographs by comparing them with Stephen Darbyshire's photos of the famous Coniston saucer. The comparison, by means of orthographic projection, proved the spaceship photographed in England had the same ratio of dimensions as the spacecraft I photographed hovering over Palomar Gardens in Southern California. 6 British Book Center, Incorporated, New York. Cramp also proved that it would be impossible for someone to copy my photographs and make a model of a spaceship that would have exactly the same ratios of dimension when photographed from a different angle. The scales of measurement, from porthole to flange, cabin height and diameter, and top to bottom, were all identical in both the English and American photographs. After the Bournemouth lecture, I returned to London and stayed with Disney and Leslie and his family. Another lecture was held in Caxton Hall on April 28. The next lecture was held at the Birmingham Institute on April 29. All arrangements for the lecture had been placed in the hands of the Institute faculty. This well-known body, dedicated to scientific truth and culture, offers its services to persons whom it determines are worthy of merit. The Institute Hall, with a seating capacity of more than 750, was filled to overflowing. The audience gave serious attention. Manchester was next on my schedule. Here, on May 1, 1959, I gave a lecture in Holdsworth Hall. Success here was equal to that of all previous efforts. In each place my film was very well received and heartily applauded. Throughout the British Isles there were many more lectures than those specifically mentioned here. In Scotland, where the weather was cold with snow and penetrating winds, I contracted a sore throat and a cold. These became so severe that on May 4 I telegraphed a message to Desmond Leslie, "No more lectures until I get over my cold." The brief rest which followed gave me a chance to partly regain my health, so that I could go on to one of the most heartwarming experiences of my lecture tour, a private audience with Her Majesty Queen Juliana of the Netherlands. 4. The Royal Audience. During my stay in Brisbane I received a letter from Ray d'Aquila of The Hague, Netherlands, requesting me to attend an interview with Queen Juliana on May 18, 1959. The letter requested an immediate reply. I sent a cable confirming receipt of the letter and consenting to the interview. Toward the end of April, when I returned to London from lectures in outlying cities of the British Isles, the rumor was out that I was to have an interview with Queen Juliana. I was at the home of Desmond Leslie when the telephone rang. It was a reporter asking for verification of the interview. I admitted only that such a rumor existed, and did not confirm anything. The reporter was cautioned not to publish anything until it had been confirmed. He agreed to await confirmation, out of respect for Queen Juliana, but his respect was apparently short-lived. The Daily Herald of April 29, 1959, London, published the following article under the heading, "Juliana's New Joy, Flying Saucers." The reporter gave this account. "I checked with Juliana's secretary. Yes," the secretary said over the phone from Holland. "Her Majesty has asked Mr. Adamski to confidential talks. More than that I cannot disclose. The talk will be between the two of them alone." The newspaper accounts which claimed I told reporters of the forthcoming meeting with Queen Juliana were entirely false. One thing is certain. The press was furious. The reporters could not get any information from me, so they fabricated stories to save face, and perhaps to protect their jobs. Newspapers all over the United States copied these false reports and added comments as they passed them on. An article in the Los Angeles Examiner of May 19, entitled "In Dutch on Saucer Discussion," stated, "The press has given Adamski, from Los Angeles, a chilly reception." The Catholic People's Party newspaper De Volkskrant said, for example, "We are not opposed to a court jester on the green lawns of the royal palace, provided he is not taken for an astronomical philosopher." Soon after the newspaper De Volkskrant criticized my interview with Queen Juliana, several other Dutch papers followed suit and began to speak in a critical vein. The more dignified papers, however, presented straightforward accounts like the following: "Queen Juliana sees U.S. writer, hours discussion on space travel," from our correspondent, The Hague, May 19. "Queen Juliana and the Prince of the Netherlands today received, at Soestdijk Palace, Mr. George Adamski, the American author of several books on space travel. The Queen and Prince Bernhard had a talk lasting about an hour with Mr. Adamski. It is understood that the talk was of a purely informative character. The Queen and Prince Bernhard wanted to become acquainted with Mr. Adamski and his views. Those who were present at the conversation included Mr. C. Kolff, President of the Royal Netherlands Society for Aviation, Lieutenant General H. Schaper, Chief of the Royal Netherlands Air Staff, Professor John Bloed, of Utrecht University, an expert in medical science dealing with aviation, and Professor Roux, of Amsterdam University, who gives lectures on mass communication. Mr. Adamski, who claims to have flown round the moon in a flying saucer and to have been in contact with inhabitants of the planet Venus, is lecturing in The Hague and Amsterdam. As I am a common man with no title or position, some newspapers questioned the Queen's right to invite me to the palace. A true ruler, or representative of the people, can gain knowledge from the lowest as well as the highest sources. The press called Die Queen gullible and accused her of falling for strange things. This is not true. She is only interested in all new things of life, as a ruler should be. We are living in times when on every hand things are changing.